This is legendary, it's never secondary. Getting better every January. The idea of it alone is very scary. I kill my enemies by any means necessary. I said, this is legendary, it's never secondary. Getting better every January. The idea of it alone is very scary. I kill my enemies by any means necessary.
Free Mumia, free Mumia.
This is Suzanne Ross for International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and all the New York City support groups for Mumia. In the midst of the amazing news that Mumia will finally be getting the cure for the hepatitis C condition he's been suffering from for over 2 years, there will be a critical court hearing on his case in Philadelphia on Monday, April 24th at 9 a.m. The court hearing at the Criminal Justice Center is about overturning all of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decisions from 1995 to 2008 that denied Mumia his freedom. To join the caravan from New York City, call me, Suzanne Ross, at 212-927-2924. Again, that's 212-927-2924. We demand Mumia's immediate release from prison.
Does this sound familiar? I might need these papers one day. I'm totally out of bookshelf space. I can't resist a going out of business sale. I have things I can donate, but just can't seem to get them together. Well, you should attend Declutter Your Life, the Spring Intensive. It's free and reservations are absolutely required. Declutter Your Life, the Spring Intensive takes place 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 25th, 215 West 125th Street, 3rd floor in Harlem. Call 646-639-4979. That's 646-639-4979 and make your reservation. Remember, less is the new more.
Hi. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and I'm one of the hosts of The Morning Show, which airs Monday through Friday, 6 to 8 a.m. on this station. WBAI is listener-supported, commercial-free, resistance radio, challenging norms and defying them. Let's break down what that means. It means that no clandestine corporate entity tells me how to do my show. You better believe that. It means that you, the listener, and the diverse WBAI community have a voice which reverberates across the tri-state area. You drive this station, so fuel us. Donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone by texting the letters WBAI to 41444. And thank you for your support.
Hi, I'm Paul DiRienzo, host of a new program on WBAI, the Thursday edition of Trump Watch, the first 100 days. On Trump Watch, we dissect and inspect the administration of President Donald J. Trump, searching for meaning in the chaos. Tune in every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. following the evening news. Listen while you still can.
Welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI Pacifica in New York City. I'm Mark Hannay, director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In the first half of the program, we're going to be taking a look at community organizing that's going on in a couple of congressional districts here in New York around the healthcare issue as it takes front and center stage with the new Congress and president. In the second half of the program, Bob Lederer will be here giving us an update on the health of Mumia Abu-Jamal and his court case and so forth, so stay tuned for that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. NPR reports that while the 2016 federal income taxes are due by this week for several million people, so is a likely tax fine for failing to have health insurance. For the majority of tax filers who've had insurance last year through an employer or government program, all they have to do is check the box on their tax form that says they were covered for a full year, and that's it. However, under a decision by the Trump administration, leaving that box blank will not get your tax return kicked back to you under a new executive order calling on federal agencies to minimize the burden of the health law. Those with no insurance or a lengthy gap in coverage may be required to pay what the federal government calls a shared responsibility payment. It's a fine for not having coverage on the theory that even those without insurance will eventually use the healthcare system at a cost they can't afford, and someone else, mainly taxpayers, will have to pick up the bill. Many people without insurance, however, qualify for one of several dozen exemptions from the fine. Nearly 13 million tax filers claimed an exemption for their 2015 taxes. The most common exemptions were for people whose income was so low they're not required to file a tax return, Americans who lived abroad for most of the year, and people for whom the cheapest available insurance was still unaffordable, meaning it cost more than 8% of their household income. The fine for 2016 taxes is the greater of either $695 per adult or 2.5% of household income. Fines for uncovered children are half that for adults. Fines are prorated by the number of months you or a family member was uninsured. The maximum fine is $2,676. Last year, an estimated 6.5 million tax filers paid a fine, which averaged about $470. ABC News reports that a much higher sign-up deadline and tighter sign-up deadline and coverage delays will be waiting for some health insurance customers now that President Trump's administration has finished a plan designed to stabilize shaky insurance markets. Under a set of changes announced last week, customers will have a shorter time period to choose a 2018 plan and have a harder time enrolling outside that window if they lose a job or have some other special circumstance that affects their coverage. Insurers will also have more flexibility to design lower cost coverage for the Affordable Care Act's new health insurance exchanges. These exchanges were established as a way for people to compare and shop for insurance coverage. But insurers have raised prices sharply or abandoned markets in many regions in recent years, leaving some customers with little or no choices. Some companies are considering leaving more markets for next year because they say they are losing money. The administration has responded with a series of changes aimed at reducing the number of insurance company defections while it pursues a broader remake of the federal law with Congress. These changes may help convince insurers to return to the market for next year, but they could also make shopping tougher for consumers in a few ways. Customers will have only 45 days to shop for 2018 coverage starting November 1st and ending December 15th. In previous years, they had twice that much time and could still buy coverage up until the end of January. The tighter time frame aims to prevent people from gaming the system by waiting until they become sick before signing up for coverage. The smaller enrollment window could be tough on some shoppers because they often have to search for an insurance plan that includes their doctors to avoid a big medical bill out of network. That's no quick task when a patient has several doctors, insurers are leaving the exchanges, and those that remain have narrow doctor networks. The shoppers then have to figure out whether they can afford the coverage and if any tax credits are available to help. The Boston Globe reports that drug addiction experts battling soaring overdose rates worry President Trump has not lived up to repeated campaign pledges to curb opioid abuse, favoring a tough-on-crime approach rather than treatment programs as he promised. While the White House heralds a new opioid addiction study commission, advocates say they want action, not further study. The epidemic, largely triggered by legal prescription drugs, is already clearly defined, they say, and remains by most accounts out of control. In an emotional moment from candidate Trump in Portsmouth, New Hampshire during the campaign, he pledged to push for a broad program to stem the tide of addiction and fatal overdoses. However, as president, his policies have fallen short of these promises. His proposed budget did not contain any more money for the treatment programs he discussed on the campaign trail. In his most specific action, he recently set up a special study commission, which is being led by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Advocates contend Trump is passing up opportunities to crack down on the pharmaceutical industry, which reports have said have fueled the prescription opioid epidemic. They were again angered by the administration's willingness to remove mandatory coverage provisions from the Affordable Care Act that force insurers to pay for mental health and addiction treatment. There are other complaints, too, including Trump's proposed funding cuts to the National Institutes of Health, which could harm critical research into the brain science of addiction, and cuts that would gut the Community Development Block Grant Program, which helps fund many local treatment centers and programs. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment, taking a look at all the community organizing that's happening in congressional districts in relation to health care reform, the Affordable Care Act, and Medicaid. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action here on WBAI Pacifica Radio. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment today, we're going to be taking a look at all the community organizing that's happening around the country as part of response to the new Congress, the new president, and particularly the healthcare issue, because it has been the first sort of issue out of the gate. Joining us, we have Pat Kane, who's a treasurer with the New York State Nurses Association based on Staten Island. Sally McMahon, who's a lead organizer and co-founder of Fight Back Bay Ridge, and Shelley Friedman, who's a community organizer with Citizen Action of New York. We're going to be taking a look at two particular congressional districts here in New York where that community organizing is happening. One is here in New York City, the 11th Congressional District, and the other is the 19th Congressional District, which is a bit up the Hudson, Catskills. Hudson gets a little bit of the northern New York City suburbs, too. So let's sort of do a little bit of basics on each of these districts. Shelley, let me start with you since you're upstate. Tell us a little bit about the district. What areas does it cover, and who are the kind of people who are the constituents?
Yeah, sure. So Congressional District 19 includes Ulster County, Dutchess, Sullivan, Greene, Columbia, and then further north, Delaware, Schoharie, Oswego, and Rensselaer districts, counties, and you know, it's a relatively rural county. We've got a lot of small business owners, and a lot of folks who have been also really engaged lately and concerned about John Faso's stance on healthcare at the federal level.
Great. And anything in politically, the history of the district or what its character is?
Yeah, sure. So the district has been relatively moderate, has gone back and forth. We had a Republican representative before Faso. I think people were more pleased with the responsiveness of the congressman before Faso, and I think I've been frustrated lately with what I think they see as John Faso being sort of unresponsive and disconnected from the people here.
Great. And he is the new current member of Congress, just started in this year, came out of the state legislature, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, and he did run for some statewide office, didn't he? Sometime in the recent past, I think, controller or something like that. Anyway, okay, so let's take a look at the 11th Congressional District here in New York City. Pat, you're on the Staten Island side. Sally's on the Brooklyn side. So let's start with you, Sally. What parts of Brooklyn does the district encompass?
Hi. So Congressional District 11 encompasses Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst, Bath Beach, Gravesend, I think that's it.
And Diker Heights.
And Diker Heights, thank you.
That's right. And tell us a little bit about the character of that part of the district.
So the character of that part of the district is basically people who have lived there for their whole lives. Children tend to stay and grow up in the same neighborhood. It is. It's a very interesting part of Brooklyn because of that kind of community-minded and community-centered things. Houses often get passed down from generation to generation. We do have more and more an influx of young people coming in. Bay Ridge in particular is a very large immigrant neighborhood. It always has been. And Bensonhurst has been seeing some changes from basically an Italian neighborhood to now becoming more of a Chinese neighborhood.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting to watch the changes and the growth in the neighborhood.
So, Pat, over on the other side of the bridge, the Verrazano Narrow Bridge, is the major part of the district, the entire island of Staten Island. Tell us a little bit about what the district's like over on that side.
Hi, Mark. Thanks. Well, there's a lot of Italian-American, Irish-American, more Russian-American coming in. I think Staten Island, the demographics have changed significantly over the past 10 years, and we are becoming a more diverse borough. In contrast to something that Sally said, I think a lot of the Staten Island, the younger people here are moving out. I think a lot of the generations, the next generation is, a lot of them are going to New Jersey and some other places. I think we have more of an elderly population here.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, we're known as the most conservative district in New York, so in New York City.
Right. And there's a lot of union density, is there not, on Staten Island?
Yes, absolutely. We have very high union density, I believe the highest in the city. A lot of those are uniform, our police and fire department. A lot of those folks live on Staten Island and other public unions as well. But we do have a very high union density, which often surprises people in terms of how conservatively people vote here.
Right. So, Shelley, taking a look at your district then, since the new administration came to power and the new Congress came into office, what has been the response of constituents up in the district?
Well, you know, I think people have been really concerned about what they see happening at the federal level, and they've had really sincere questions for Representative Faso about what his approach will be. I think that people have been very, very thoughtful and open to hearing from John Faso, and frankly have been really frustrated because he has so far refused to hold a genuine, open, accessible town hall for his constituents. So folks have really been, you know, people have been persistent to send letters and make phone calls and come to his office and have meetings and really want to hear from him. And, you know, we did, there was back in February when Congressman Faso was on recess and refusing to hold a town hall, you know, over 1,000 people showed up to a town hall which he did not attend and had questions answered by other members of the community. And I think in response to that, now, you know, on this recess, he had a town hall out of the district up in Troy that was staged, ticketed event with limited seating. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people that still have questions for him and are calling on him to be more responsive and to protect our to protect the health of his constituents.
And I understand there was a big crowd outside of that, correct?
That's right. Yes, there was a rally of over 50 people were there.
On the
also
inside?
Calling on him. Yeah.
Okay. And great. And it just sounds like a very familiar story, Pat and Sally, here in the city, too.
Mm-hmm.
You're a member
yes.
of Congress. Tell us about him. We haven't spoken about him yet. His name is Dan Donovan. He comes from Staten Island. Pat, what's his background?
He was the district attorney for Staten Island prior to winning his seat in a special election that was held when Michael Grimm
resigned because of his conviction. Yes, he was convicted on tax fraud.
It's still hard to say it. Almost, I don't know.
Exactly.
It's hard. It's just you know.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. So he won a special election in 2015, and then held on to the seat in the general election.
And he's most known as district attorney for a recent situation involving the police. Correct.
Yes, in the Eric Garner case, Dan Donovan was the district attorney.
Right, okay. And so, Sally, you guys with Fight Back Bay Ridge have, as Shelley was describing, been organizing your own town halls. What's Dan Donovan been doing in the last, he's been in office about 2 years now.
Yes, that's correct. Dan Donovan has not held a town hall in the 2 years that he's been our congressman. He refuses to hold a town hall, a live town hall. His argument is that he was disrupted at a Chamber of Commerce breakfast by a handful of protesters, and therefore he will not meet with the public in an open forum for fear of that happening again. However, there were maybe 20 people there, and it was not... He says that people were escorted out, that... you know, people had to be forcibly removed, and none of that is true.
Yeah, I was there. That
yeah,
never
you were
happened.
There. I was there, too. That never happened. So anyway, we've been trying to get him to hold one. It's been a big push of everybody in CD11, and he's refused, so we're holding one for him. We had one on Wednesday, April 19th, and he was invited. He refused to attend. So we put together a series of experts to come in and answer questions for people.
Yes, we're taping this in advance of the event, but the broadcast will go out after the event. So we're kind of in on one side of the
yeah.
other in terms of
yeah.
time situation
yeah.
here. Pat, your organization, along with Sally's and a bunch of folks on Staten Island, including my own, we've all been kind of working together to engage Representative Donovan on the healthcare issue. There was a town hall back in February. Tell us
right,
about
during
that.
During the February break.
Yeah. What happened there?
Yeah. I thought it went very well. We held it in the North Shore of Staten Island. Over 200 people attended. Same situation. The congressman was invited and declined to come. That really, we had a panel of experts available at the front of the room. We really didn't speak much. It really ended up that the community had an awful lot to say about health care, and we really listened to what they had to say. You know, I mean, it was successful from the standpoint of the community organizing piece. It was a shame that the congressman wasn't there to hear the concerns of those constituents.
Yeah, there have been some very compelling personal stories that have been shared in this event.
Absolutely.
And Sally, your group back in February did a town hall in the streets, right?
Yes. Dan Donovan holds teletown halls where he takes only pre-screened questions. He claims he connects with like 14,000 families, but maybe 10 people get to ask a question and they are pre-screened. So in protest of that, a number of community organizations got together outside of his office in Brooklyn during that live town hall, you know, with signs, speak to us in person, things like that.
And he's got some of those. He's trying a new thing with Facebook now, too, right?
Yes. So he has decided not just to have the teletown hall, which is happening tonight, but he is scheduling three Facebook town halls. One with each one with a different reporter, and that reporter will moderate the questions that come in through Facebook Live. So, again, it will be pre-screened questions.
So you, just to get a little sense of how this would work, I would log on to Facebook Live and watch it, and then while I was there, I could send a question off somewhere? Is that how
I think so. I'm not really quite sure how he's setting them up. The only information his office has published so far is that he will be having them and who the three reporters are who are moderating. Other than that, I don't really know.
And I suppose you could reach out to the reporters directly with some questions if you wanted to. They're all on Twitter.
Yeah, most of us are live tweeting our questions. So, well, not live tweeting, but tweeting, you know, at Rachel Shapiro, at Paula Katinas.
Great. Shelley, let me bring you back into the conversation here. This is a new era for people doing community organizing. We have the use of all these new digital technologies. Tell us a little bit about how you're using that and how it's working for you.
Sure, absolutely. We, you know, we've been able to engage thousands more people through Facebook and Twitter. Actually, during the town hall back in February, we were trending on Twitter nationally when folks, thousands of people were holding up signs that said "No Show Faso" and really bringing attention to what is happening with these Republicans coming back to their communities. And so that's been really effective. We've also been using different platforms to gather people's stories. So people on Facebook have been submitting information about how the Republican legislation would impact them and how the Affordable Care Act has allowed them to access health care. So that's been really a valuable tool as well.
And you've had a thing going up there called Faso Fridays. Tell us some of the things that have been happening on Faso Fridays.
Sure, yeah. So we've been engaging every Friday at noon. We have a standing appointment with John Faso, John Faso's office there, where easily 50 to 75, sometimes over 100 people are coming out. And it's really just a regular opportunity to people for people to come and submit comments, go into the office. They actually had to, they ended up creating a pop-up office for us because there was such a volume of people coming through every Friday. So they have special members from his office that come down and meet us and hear our concerns. And you know, folks are standing out by the street and people are driving by during their lunch breaks and honking and offering their support. But it's been a really, I think, important way for people who are concerned to be with other folks that share those concerns and also organize follow-up steps from that. And we've gathered some media attention from that as well, that I think what we really want is for Faso to see that we are paying attention and to remember that he works for us.
And has he taken a position on the new Republican health care bill called the American Health Care Act? I know he served on one of the committees.
Yeah, right. So he actually was the deciding vote to move the bill out of committee. And, you know, he helped write the Faso-Collins Amendment that was going to, you know, to help appease the radical right-wing members of Congress. And he said that he was going to vote yes, right up until the bill was pulled because there weren't even enough votes to pass it. So he's saying all that at the same time as he's saying that he's going to, you know, fix what doesn't work. You know, and this was a bill that was going to take away health care from millions of people at the expense of his constituents to give tax breaks to the wealthiest. So, you know, there's a really legitimate concern that he's, you know, saying one thing and then doing something completely different. So there's definitely distrust here.
And Sally and Pat, there was a surprise with Dan Donovan. What position did he take ultimately on the bill? Sally, I guess I'll start with you.
Well, originally, my understanding was he was voting yes for the AHCA, but he did change his mind. He was very bombarded by his constituents. We had three rallies within the space of, I think, 4 days, two at his Brooklyn office, one at his Staten Island office. There were a series of events planned and going on at his Staten Island office. I had my group we called every single day for a couple of weeks. There must have been a couple hundred people calling to tell him to vote no, to vote no, to vote no, to protect the ACA. And then at the very end, when the changes were made to appease the Freedom Caucus, that was when he came out with his no. I don't know if we had much of an influence on him. I like to think we did, but it looked as if the Freedom Caucus, the changes to the Freedom Caucus and how it would have hurt New York was what finally made up his mind.
And Pat, you've been in a couple of meetings with him in your position with the State Nurses Association. What's he like? Why do you think he took the position he did?
Why do I think he took the position he did? Well, I think he, initially, the first meetings that I was at with him, he seemed very intent on that we had to repeal the ACA. He seemed very intent on that. His, most of the time when he spoke, he was focusing on small businesses and how it had hurt them. The second time I went to see him, and I really felt, by the way, that the Medicare issue was not on his radar at all.
The Medicaid
at that time.
Aspect.
And that was back in December. Medicaid, yeah. Sorry. You know, I really felt like Medicaid wasn't really on his radar at all, or that he wouldn't really talk about it. Second time we went to see him, I felt, you know, he spoke a little bit more about Medicaid. He spoke about the, you know, the so-called original intention of Medicaid to, you know, he had like a sentence that he kept repeating that sounded very rehearsed, actually, about Medicaid. And we gave him the facts and figures for Staten Island and his district, and he seemed surprised by them. We also spoke about the impact to the hospitals, the jobs, and economy, in addition to the patients that Medicaid was serving. And he did seem to consider that during the meeting. Some of it did seem like it might have been new information. And, you know, I do feel that all of his constituents bombarding him with phone calls and the actions that we have been taking did make a difference. And his staff has actually said that.
Great.
And I do believe it did make a difference.
Good. Well, it's time to wrap things up here. We've been taking a look at all the community organizing going on around the health care bill in two particular congressional districts in our area, one right here in New York City, the 11th Congressional District, which covers all of Staten Island and Southwest Brooklyn, and the 19th Congressional District, which covers the very northern part of the suburbs and up the Mid-Hudson Valley and Catskill region. Joining us has been Pat Kane, treasurer with the New York State Nurses Association, Sally McMahon, a lead organizer and co-founder of Fight Back Bay Ridge, and Shelley Friedman, a community organizer with Citizen Action of New York. Thanks, Pat, Sally, and Shelley for joining us on this for this discussion.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, all of us. Yes, exactly. And thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this segment. I'm Mark Hannay. We'll be back with the second half of the program. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned for an interview Bob Letter conducts looking at the issue of Mumi Abdul-Jamal's health condition and court cases and so forth. Stay tuned for that.
Does this sound familiar? I might need these papers one day. I'm totally out of bookshelf space. I can't resist a going out of business sale. I have things I can donate, but just can't seem to get them together. Well, you should attend Declutter Your Life, the Spring Intensive. It's free, and reservations are absolutely required. Declutter Your Life, the Spring Intensive takes place 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 25th. 215 West 125th Street, 3rd floor in Harlem. Call 646-639-4979. That's 646-639-4979 and make your reservation. Remember, less is the new more.
This is Bob Letterer. In this segment, we'll discuss a major victory for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal in his battle for hepatitis C treatment, as well as a crucial court case coming up on April 24th, when Mumia's attorneys will argue for overturning his murder conviction based on a recent Supreme Court precedent. First, to Mumia's health. On Thursday, April 6th, pursuant to a federal court order that he had long fought for, Mumia finally began to receive potentially curative treatment for his long-standing hepatitis C infection. He will take the daily pills, known as Harvoni, for 12 weeks. Mumia, 62, is being held at the Mahanoy Correctional Institute in Frackville, Pennsylvania. He first tested positive for hepatitis C in 2012, yet prison health officials took no steps to treat him, even after much more powerful drugs with a 90 to 95% cure rate were approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2013. The drug manufacturer charges $60,000 to $85,000 for a 12-week course of treatment. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections refused to begin administering the drug to any incarcerated person with hepatitis C. In March 2015, after months of excruciating body-wide skin itching, Mumia fell into a diabetic coma and nearly died. Mumia's outside personal doctor, Joseph Harris, did intensive research that revealed that both conditions were known to be complications of hepatitis C infection. Only after Mumia filed a federal lawsuit in 2015 demanding that he be treated was the department forced to admit that their so-called treatment protocol actually was a standard for denial of treatment to all but those at death's door, and that out of an estimated 5,000 to 7,000 incarcerated people with hepatitis C statewide, only 5 people at that point had actually been treated. After a long legal struggle and repeated political mobilizations, federal judge Robert Mariani ruled in September 2016 that the Pennsylvania prison system's standard of treatment was barbaric and unconstitutional. But not until January 2017 did he order that Mumia be treated within 3 weeks. Pennsylvania went to the federal appeals court seeking a stay in this order, which was denied them on March 27th. While a motion from Mumia's lawyers to hold the state in contempt was pending, finally, on April 5th, Judge Mariani ordered that Mumia's treatment begin the next day and that Mumia's attorneys be kept informed of the progress of the course of treatment. And in the meantime, Mumia has now been diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver, a very severe state of it that is the product of this incredible delay in providing him the medical care that he very much needed. And we're joined now by two guests. Bob Boyle is a longtime criminal defense attorney who has represented Mumia Abu-Jamal and other U.S. political prisoners. And Pam Africa is the leader of International Concern Family and Friends of Mumia and also the Minister of Confrontation for the MOVE organization. And she joins us from Philadelphia. Well, let me start with you, Bob. So tell us about this legal victory that you and your co-counsel, Brett Grody of the Abolition Law Center, have won with the backing of a large international movement of support for Mumia. What exactly is this order, and what does it represent?
The order was actually issued, as you indicated, back in January. Then, after that, the Department of Correction filed various motions with the court to try to delay implementation of the order, I think fully realizing that the order in Mumia's case could be used as a precedent to ensure the treatment of the, at a minimum, I think, 5,000 other prisoners in the state of Pennsylvania who have chronic hepatitis C. So they filed motions for reconsideration, an appeal to the Third Circuit, so forth and so on. Then on, as you indicated, on March 27th, the Pennsylvania, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, denied their motion to stay, that is, delay Judge Mariani's order. In the meantime, we had already filed a motion to have the Department of Corrections held in contempt, because Judge Mariani's order in January was very specific. It said, I want testing done within 7 days, within 14 days, and then treatment to begin 7 days after that, unless there's a medical reason not to give treatment. So they didn't comply with any of that. And after the Court of Appeals denied the stay motion, that is the delay motion, they did some testing, and following that testing, made the determination to treat Mumia. Now, this is a victory, but it's a very bittersweet victory, because while the legal proceedings have been pending, and the Department of Corrections has done delay after delay after delay, Mumia's condition deteriorated. It deteriorated to the extent that he's now classified as having cirrhosis, fibrosis level 4, which is a serious disease. And so, while it certainly is, I think, a victory on the part of the political campaign and the legal work that we did in court, we have to also recognize that Mumia's condition deteriorated during this process, and the treatment is happening much too late. And you have to wonder how many people there are in the prisons in Pennsylvania and in the prisons throughout this country, and people on Medicaid on the street who are being denied these drugs that will cure hepatitis C and whose condition is deteriorating. Mumia had this lawsuit, so they did, even with a lot of delay, they ultimately moved on it. But there's a lot of people out there who aren't getting this treatment. And once you have cirrhosis, you can have serious physical complications arising from that that are life-threatening. So, it is a victory. It's just a bittersweet one.
Well, one of the people who is really key in winning that victory is Pam Africa. And Pam, she's a leader of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia. Pam, tell us about your visit with Mumia on April 7th. That was the second day of his receiving. It's one pill a day for up to 12 weeks. Tell us how he was, how he is, and what your observations are after helping to coordinate this this international campaign that's gone on for more than 2 years now to get him what should be a basic human right to the standard of care according to all medical authorities on hepatitis C.
I went to visit Mumia Friday. That was the second day that he had taken the pill. I asked Mumia how he was feeling, and Mumia said he is really feeling good. And, that's the answer, that Mumia gives. When I asked Mumia about his feet, he was saying that they're hurting, they're swollen, and that he's having this pain, for the longest. Also, I noticed that Mumia's stomach and all was swollen, and it had been swollen, but I noticed that it was swollen more than usual. And he said that's the result of the hepatitis C. I also want to note that Mumia and I said his weight gain, he weighs 260 pounds. And also, as far as the Harvoni that he was taking, he said he's not feeling, any side effects at all from taking the Harvoni. And, but he wants us to stress the importance of people coming on April 24th and all to the hearing, the post-conviction hearing that they're having. And because it's very clear to Mumia and other people that these people are desperately trying to kill them, and they're really upset that they haven't at this particular point. And the only way that we can get Mumia out there, we're working, dealing with the hepatitis C. But the only way we can get him out is to, work on getting as many people for this post-conviction hearing, which is very important.
Pam Africa, I'm now going to play this statement that Mumia issued to his supporters just the day after his first pill for hepatitis C. Let's give that a listen.
The beginning. It has begun. Today marked the second day since I began the treatment regimen of direct-acting antiviral drugs, or DAADs, designed to eliminate hepatitis C from my system. You, the people, made this possible. You, the people, filled two courtrooms in Scranton in December 2015. You, the people, supported our lawyers, Brett Grote of Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh and Bob Boyle of New York City, as well as Dr. Joseph Harris, MD, who diagnosed me as I was nodding in and out in a wheelchair in a prison visiting room, and later served as an expert witness in our hearings in Scranton. You, the people, sent love, prayers, letters, cards, money, and strength to us all, for which the words, I thank you, seem pale in comparison. Yet, I thank you still. You, the people, are helping me heal. The battle isn't over, but this is a damn good beginning. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
So, Pam, what's your reflection on Mumia's obvious gratitude for the tremendous mobilization that's gone on? How do you look back on these last 2 years of fighting in the streets for Mumia's life and how that has affected the court proceedings?
Right. You know, when Mumia speaks of the movement and how it actually saved his life and is saving the life of many others, and through the fact that he's getting the Hargoni, you know, at this particular point, and he is overwhelmed, and the love that people have shown him, that's what he is, you know, expressing in there. And the fact that this is what carried him through all this, even when he was in the hospital. And I would say, you know, closer to death than anything else, he states very clearly it was the love that vibrated and through those walls and that helped him, you know, come to the level where he's at. He's really gratified that, you know, Bob and Brett won this case, and because it's not just about him, it's about a way of relief for all the thousands of other people inside the prisons and all who would not be getting this treatment if it wasn't for what had happened, you know, here.
And Bob, on that note, Bob Boyle, attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, what are the next steps to try to extend the application of this court order for Mumia to be treated to the other 5,000 to 7,000, incarcerated people throughout the state of Pennsylvania who have chronic hepatitis C?
Well, there is a class action pending in federal district court in Philadelphia on behalf of all of the prisoners in the state of Pennsylvania who suffer from chronic hepatitis C. And that is seeking an injunction from the court. I'm not one of the attorneys in that case, that seeking an injunction that everyone be treated. What was significant about our victory in Mumia's case was that it can be used as precedent in that case. And that is because Judge Mariani ruled that the standard of care for treating hepatitis C is to give the antiviral drugs, period. Doesn't matter how sick you are or even if you're asymptomatic yet, because it can take years to become symptomatic. So what he said was, because hepatitis C is so serious and people's physical health can deteriorate sometimes rapidly, even if there hasn't been a deterioration before that, that the standard of care is that people should be treated. So it is hoped that in the class action out of Philadelphia that the judge will come to a similar conclusion. And the record that we were able to build in the 3 days of evidence back in December of 2015, I think is an enormous help to them. In fact, they told us it's an enormous help to them. So, we're hoping that that case will move along quickly because, you know, people can die of this disease. And, you know, time is of the essence, that everyone get treated.
Indeed. And our other guest, Pam Africa, has mentioned a very important court hearing that's coming up in a Pennsylvania state court on Monday, April 24th. And Bob, I know you're not one of the attorneys on that case directly, but tell us what that case is all about and why it's so important.
Okay, just very briefly, because it is kind of procedurally very technical.
Right.
But in Mumia has, in last year, the Supreme Court ruled in the case of Williams versus Pennsylvania that this particular judge, Judge Castile, who had sat on the appellate court and ruled against Williams in his case, should have recused himself, that is, refused to consider the case because he had been the district attorney of Philadelphia when Mr. Williams was prosecuted. That same judge, Judge Castile, was also the district attorney for Philadelphia at the time of Mumia's initial post-conviction applications, and he signed all the papers. So the lawyers are going to court saying that this case out of the Supreme Court should also apply to Mumia, because this particular judge who denied the post-conviction hearing also was, at the time the post-conviction hearing was pending, was the district attorney of Philadelphia. So it's a very significant proceeding that's happening on the 24th.
And just to clarify, so in Williams' case, his conviction was overturned because of this violation of his rights, correct?
That's right.
And so that could be the consequence for Mumia as well, if the courts say that his case has the same fact pattern as the Williams case, and so the same standard should be applied. But, of course, we know that there's a long history of what many in the movement call the Mumia exception, which is laws and standards and court rulings that apply to everyone else. Somehow they twist and turn to find an excuse to not apply them to him because of who he is and who he represents.
That's true, and also it's the fact that the facts of every case are different. And in their response to the papers filed by Mumia, the district attorney in Philadelphia is arguing, well, what applied to Williams doesn't apply here. So it's all the more reason that there be an overwhelming show of political support on the 24th.
And just briefly on that, before I turn back to Pam Africa, for those who may wonder, are judges really affected by turnout of supporters in the courtroom? Bob, you've been practicing, representing political activists facing legal proceedings for decades now. What have been your observations about the real-world impact of a large number of people coming to court?
Well, I mean, I think it's on a case-by-case basis. But I would say this much, that it does have an effect on the particular case. If cases, just on the basis of the fact that if cases are decided in isolation and without public knowledge, the rules of law are more easily twisted because the judges can just say, well, we're denying this writ. No one is going to complain about it. And that person, you know, will continue to stay in jail. And in my 30 some odd years of experience, I've had that experience when I've represented, you know, individuals in not necessarily political cases. And I wish that they had the kind of support that Mumia needs. I mean, you know, just look at the effort to overturn his death sentence. That would not have happened had it not been for the, you know, for the movement in the streets.
Okay, and finally, Pam Africa, tell us why it's so important for people to turn out to Philadelphia, to this court proceeding on Monday, April 24th at 9 a.m.
Right. You know, the mere fact that this government know that every April 24th we make sure, because that's the date of Mumia's birthday, that we do something and we always try to do something big. But them to set the date for April the 24th, and we don't trust them at all. They should give Mumia a post-conviction hearing. And but to ensure that, just like to ensure that Mumia got the proper health care, and it took numbers. We need visible numbers in Philadelphia that day. On April the 24th, we're celebrating the fact that Mumia lives and the fact that he lives. And, you know, people are beginning the hepatitis C, you know, cure. There are people coming in. There's buses coming in from vans, coming in from New York. People are coming in from Delaware. We're trying to get as many people in the streets as possible and to spread the word that we do need visibility. And like I said, the demonstration is going to be all day. We're going to be at the courts. And in the afternoon, we're going to be at City Hall passing out information. That evening, there's an evening program because it doesn't end on April the 24th. We're gathering, you know, forces to continue this battle. But April 24th, again, is about Mumia living when this government has been trying their darndest to kill him. It's about the fact that this movement still lives. And that's why Mumia is alive today. And I myself want to thank everyone who has been over the years and, you know, involved in the case. Those who had to step back and come back and, you know, those that, you know, lick the stamps, do the mailings, make the phone calls, do the radio shows. Thank you all because of you, Mumia lives. And we want to continue that. And also on April 24th, we are definitely planning on filling the streets of Philadelphia to let these people know that we still care. We still love Mumia, and we're going to be there for him.
Okay. And on that note, I want to thank our guest, Pam Africa, the Minister of Confrontation for the MOVE organization and leader of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia, and as well as Bob Boyle, one of the attorneys for Mumia Abu-Jamal and a longtime criminal defense attorney representing political prisoners. Thank you both, and we'll see you in Philadelphia on April 24th. And for more information, go to www.freemumia.com. Thank you.
All right, thank you. On the MOVE. See you soon. And we will be there for Lynn Stewart.
And that wraps it up for this edition of Health Action. I'd like to thank the engineer for this segment, producer John Riley. And until next time, stay healthy, stay balanced. I'm Bob Lederer.
Free Mumia, free Mumia.
This is Suzanne Ross for International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and all the New York City support groups for Mumia. In the midst of the amazing news that Mumia will finally be getting the cure for the hepatitis C condition he's been suffering from for over 2 years, there will be a critical court hearing on his case in Philadelphia on Monday, April 24th at 9 a.m. The court hearing at the Criminal Justice Center is about overturning all of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decisions from 1995 to 2008 that denied Mumia his freedom. To join the caravan from New York City, call me, Suzanne Ross, at 212-927-2924. Again, that's 212-927-2924. We demand Mumia's immediate release from prison.
On Saturday, April 22nd, those who loved, respected, and admired the people's attorney, Lynn Stewart, will gather to celebrate her life, revisit her struggles, and reaffirm our commitment to Lynn, other ancestors, and to each other. Come to St. Peter's Church, the Jazz Church, at Lexington Avenue and 54th Street. Doors open at 2 p.m. You can take the 456 or the NQ or R trains to 59th Street. That's St. Peter's Church from 2:30 to 7 p.m. on Saturday, April 22nd, in remembrance of our legal warrior, Lynn Stewart. Because The struggle continues. Doors open at 2 p.m. For more information, go to lynnstewart.org. That's LYNNESTEWART.org. Or call 718-789-0558.
Do you think marijuana should be legalized? Would you like to see an end to the war on drugs? The New York City Cannabis Parade invites you to an annual Pro-Part March and Rally, Saturday, May 6th at 11 a.m., March 32nd Street and Broadway. Rally at 1 p.m. at Union Square. Come listen to Pro-Part politicians, marijuana advocates, and people like you discuss why marijuana should be legalized and the war on drugs should be ended. No one should go to jail for a flower. For more information, go to CannabisParade.org. Once again, join us Saturday, May 6th, 11 a.m. at 32nd and Broadway. The New York City Cannabis Parade invites you to a Pro-Pot march and rally. Help us put an end to mass incarceration. Legalize marijuana now.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
This Thursday, April 20th at 10 p.m., almost a year to the day since his ascension, the Sweet Spot hosts a very special tribute to the musical genius, Prince Rogers Nelson. Joining your host, Baby K, and Kyle in the studio will be funk rock queen Shelly Nicole of Blackbush. Shelly will be sharing reflections from her year-long purple meditation and sound, 365 Days of Prince. And, of course, we will be playing the jams.
Shut up already!
That's the Sweet Spot Salute to Prince, Thursday, April 20th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
Listeners of WBAI, join Earth Mom for karaoke at the Commons Cafe, Friday, April 21st at 7 p.m., located at 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt Street and Bond Street in Brooklyn, New York. Your $10 donations at the door will go directly to WBAI. However, no one will be turned away at the door. Refreshing drinks and tasty snacks are available. Don't forget, April 21st, 7 p.m., karaoke at the Commons Cafe.
If you've ever cut your grass and found a car, you might be a redneck.
Did you know that WBAI has a car donation program? Another way to support this station is by donating a vehicle, a car, a truck, RV, or even a boat. To donate a vehicle in support of WBAI, call us at 1-866-WBAI-CAR. That's 1-866-922-4227. WBAI's partners will take all of your information and take care of the details. You can also visit WBAI.org and click on the Ways to Donate banner for more information. Again, that number is 1-866-WBAI-CAR. And then you can leave the lawn ornaments to Foxworthy and friends.
Well, that was certainly a rude noise, wasn't it? I have been told this has something to do with a media player, when if there are like two instances of it running. Let's see. Is it still the case? Dare I try it again? Whoops. Okay. Well, first of all, that is supposed to be over. Okay, good. That's done. There we go. That's the sound we like to hear at 1 a.m. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us via Skype this morning, grid willing, is Jessica Reisman, who will be discussing and reading from her new novel, Substrate Phantoms. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. For better or worse, I need to focus on a relatively minor moment of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the first film to extend J.K. Rowling's Potterverse beyond its original protagonist. It's supposed to be part of one of the dramatic highlights of the film, but given the overstuffed and somewhat diffuse nature of the narrative, that doesn't count for much. In the sequence, one of the characters, Porpentina Goldstein, played by Catherine Waterston, is sentenced by the New York City-based governing body of wizards to death because reasons. She's taken into a chamber that has a chair suspended over a pool of liquid. One of her captors waves a wand at her temple, at which point Tina, as she's called throughout most of the film, sees images of friends and family beckoning to her from beneath the surface of the pool. The captor, a gentle African-American woman, one of the few in the film which makes the choice of her for this role interesting, shall we say, invites her into the chair. We then get the fantasy version of the old maiden tied to the railroad tracks bit, as our film's hero, Newt's commander, played by Eddie Redmayne, who's next in line for this treatment, struggles to free himself from his handcuffs as Tina, mesmerized, is slowly lowered toward the liquid, which is now reaching up toward her as a dark maw rimmed by glowing ash. Of everything in this film, which as directed by David Yates, who helmed the latter chapters of the Potter films to lesser and sometimes greater effect, and is written by Rowling in his sole screenwriting credit, is full of strange and wonderful moments done with no holds or budget-barred visual panache, I cannot let this moment go. It perplexes me about what I'm supposed to understand about the Society of Wizards, about those at the higher levels of its governing structure, about how we're meant to see it in contrast to the world of Muggles, which we learn here are called, awkwardly, nomadges by American wizards. J.K. apparently hasn't spent quite enough time talking with Americans, New Yorkers in particular, to get our slang down. The execution apparently is supposed to be painless and humane, yet Yates, and I'm presuming Rowling as well, play it for its inherent and quite obvious horror. It could be that Rowling is making a point about the hypocrisy of so-called humane methods of capital punishment, but within the context of the Potterverse as a whole, it speaks to Rowling's difficulties in giving her wizarding world a depth beyond the whims of a child's fantasy. Frankly, the more I see of Rowling's Society of Wizards, I'm looking at you, Dolores Umbridge, and your black quill, the more I wonder why any child, or adult for that matter, would want to be a part of it. I can understand the appeal to a child's rebellious spirit, but in a world where its heroes are trapped between fear of the non-wizarding world and subjugation to an oppressive and frequently sadistic ruling body, which, because this film is set in the late 20s, has apparently continued unmodified for close to a century at least, where's the appeal? Where's the fun? There needs to be darkness and antagonists and all that, but goddammit, can't the good guys lighten up a bit? Interestingly, the character in Fantastic Beasts that most engaged me wasn't the committed Fantastic Beast Hunter Newt Scamander with his suitcase full of strange and frequently enchanting creatures, or the noble Tina Goldstein, or her free-spirited psychic sister Queenie, played by Alison Sudol, but Jacob Kowalski, a New York muggle who's not completely reluctantly dragooned into Newt's adventures, and who, as charmingly played by Dan Fogler, mixes a common-sense attitude with a childlike wonder for all the magical stuff swirling around him. Kowalski was so appealing, in fact, that I was left wishing we were following his story, confronting amazing things for the first time, rather than casting our lot with those for whom the fantastic has become a matter of everyday course. That may be the upshot of a film in conflict with itself, wanting to be its own beast, excuse me, while at the same time functioning as a brand extension for a worldwide franchise. All the stuff that enchanted me about Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. And there's a lot here. Yates finds action and humor and occasionally visual poetry in the tale of an eccentric wizard recovering his escaped beasties through 1920s New York. The stuff that enchanted me was pretty much all the stuff outside of the Potterverse. The franchise stuff, which includes a new version of Voldemort and another special magical child, although in the film's defense, there's a twist to that that isn't particularly good, but at least doesn't slavishly reiterate the Potter series, works more to undermine the magic of the tale rather than enhance it. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them in moments is truly magical, but in the end, the whole is less than all its many, many, too many parts. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. I'll beg to disagree on a few things. Number one, I agree that it is overall, I walked out of that movie and I really enjoyed it. I will say that. And I also concur that the best character in the film is without question Jacob. And I wouldn't have minded, as Dan suggests, following along his story. And through him, let's meet Tina and Newt and the others. By the way, I think the author's name is Rowling, as in rolling along, as in row, row, row your boat, not Rowling. It's a common mistake, but pretty sure that it's Rowling. But I've been wrong before. It wouldn't be a first time. Okay, let's see if Skype is working. Jessica, are you there? Uh-oh, that doesn't bode well. Let's try that again. Can you hear me, Jessica? Okay, we may very well be having Skype issues. Let me call our guest using my phone. It did say something about couldn't access the speaker setting before, but let us see. Hey, Jessica.
I can hear you.
You can hear me. You can hear our air, but I'm not hearing you for some reason. Yeah, that's fun. Okay, say something for me again.